Our first story today takes us back to 1940s Hollywood into the studio suite of one of the biggest movie producers of the day, David O. Selznick. Selznick brought lots of novels to the screen, including David Copperfield and Rebecca, and he introduced Alfred Hitchcock and Ingrid Bergman to American audiences. But he always worried that he would be remembered only as the producer of his most successful film, Gone with the Wind. To people who knew him in Hollywood, though, what they vividly recall is Selznick's raving obsession with sending office memos. Eric Molinsky dug into the archives.
In the business world of the 1920s and 30s, people didn't really do lunch, not like now. The phones were cumbersome. Obviously, there's no email. So people who worked together either met face-to-face or they wrote memos. Hollywood producer David O. Selznick had another reason for writing memos. He was working for his father, the film mogul Louis J. Selznick, and David found himself dictating company policy at the age of 17.
He found that by communicating, by sitting down and writing a memo, he could make his point better than walking in and people saying, who's this young kid?
Rudy Belmer is a film historian who compiled an entire book of Selznick's memos.
He could be succinct. At first he was succinct. And he could make his point, and he thought he could kind of hide behind a typewritten memoranda.
Selznick rose to become a top producer at MGM, working for his father-in-law, Louis B. Mayer. But he wanted to run his own studio. In 1933, he dictated a memo to his father-in-law that declared his independence. It was a moment he'd later look back upon with great pride.
June 14th, 1933. Dear Dad, I write you instead of telling you verbally because I've learned that I write much better than I talk. Because I want to be sure I tell you exactly how I feel. I want to get out of MGM, and the quicker, the better. The letter is useful to me in establishing one thing. Never again will I take a major step on anyone's opinion but my own. This may sound vain, but it is true.
Selznick wanted to do the job of every person in the studio. He micromanaged the directors, the writers, the casting agents, the composers, and he supervised the casting couch.
So this was David O. Selznick, you know, and he was not a producer who sat around and hoped everything would work out.
I spoke today to Walter Plunkett about Gable's costumes. I think there was no excuse for their fitting him so badly, especially around the collar. The trick about collars on anyone with a large neck is to make the collars slightly large so they don't press against the neck and make it look as though it's bulging.
I'd like to get a new name for Phyllis Walker. I don't want anything too fancy, and I would like to get a first name that isn't carried by a dozen other girls in Hollywood. Personally, I would like to decide on Jennifer and get a one-syllable last name that has...
Alfred Hitchcock. Dear Hitch, cutting your film with a camera and reducing the number of angles is highly desirable, but certainly it's of no value if you are going simply to give us less cut film per day than a man who shoots twice as many angles. There are various things about your methods of shooting which I think you simply must correct.
At this time, Selznick also got addicted to the stimulant Benzedrine, which allowed him to work 20 hours a day. Directors would wake up to find a 5,000-word memo tucked under their door, and they wouldn't bother to read it because they knew another one would be arriving before lunch.
One of the problems is, I think, that he never reread them.
David Thompson wrote the authorized biography on Selznick, which he called Showman.
And many of them, I think, if he had reread, they would have been very different. Because he was not an unkind man. In many ways, he was a very fond, sentimental man. And there was something about pacing around. He would take his shoes off, walk around the office in his socks. And time and again, people told me the motion of walking around added to the momentum and the fury and the ferocity and the self-justification of the memos and to the kind of insult there was in them for the person who was going to receive it.
Selznick didn't just use the memos to give orders. It became his creative tool. When Ingrid Bergman wanted out of her contract, Selznick dictated a memo to himself in Bergman's voice and sent it to her.
To Mr. David O. Selznick, Dear David, I shall set forth herein a summary of the facts in my dispute with you. You brought me to this country when I was unknown to English-speaking audiences. When I finished my contract with you, I had become one of the greatest stars in the world. This development taking place entirely while I was under your management. Unfortunately for you, I forgot everything that I wanted. I forgot all about my promises and statements through the years. I forgot everything you had done for me.
Although he cherished his own independence, Selznick couldn't understand why anyone would want to be free from his golden touch. He often felt betrayed, as many of the people in his life, like Bergman and the director John Huston, broke with him. His attempts to top Gone with the Wind failed. In retirement, he spent most of his days and nights dictating to a rotating crew of secretaries.
I think that if he had had a couple of degrees more self-awareness and self-honesty, I think that his life would have been happier by far, but I'm not sure that he would have produced the great films he did. I think he identified very much with the character of Scarlett O'Hara. And in the end, I think that's one of the reasons why Gone with the Wind works. He believed in her so much. He wanted her success, her survival for himself.
September 20th, 1939. To Miss Catherine Brown, story editor. Dear Kay, please tell Margaret Mitchell that I was terribly worried about the ending of the picture. We tried it two or three ways, but it didn't work, and I finally cooked up an ending of my own, which I imagine will sound pretty awful to you and Miss Mitchell, but which, believe me, worked like a charm. Accordingly, the ending is as follows.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Still crying, she sinks on the steps, moaning.
I can't let him go. I can't.
With her head in her arms, suddenly, we hear the ghost-like voices.
Tara, this from which you get your strength. Red Earth of Tara.
Well, during this, Scarlett has been emerging from her despair, raising her head slowly and reacting to the realization that she still has Tara. She lifts her head and, as the camera moves into a big close-up of her, says,
after all, tomorrow is another day.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
Ron Silver read David O. Selznick's memos for us.